SharePoint. SharePoint. Still might be able to help you. All right, we'll just wait another few seconds so that everyone can find a seat. All right, cool. Okay, so welcome to Building Responsive Web Applications with MVC 4, Web API, and HTML5. So my name's Brendan Cowitz. I work for Redify. I'm a consultant. So I kind of, you know, get around a fair bit, see a fair few projects. And some of the things here are kind of the experiences that sort of I see out in the field. So my role, is a senior developer. And if we go to the next slide. Oh, hang on. This guy doesn't seem to be working. There we go. Okay, so if you want to get in touch with me, I have an email address, brendan.cowitz@redify.net. So if you've got any questions from the slides that you see today, I have a blog, which I occasionally update, cowitz.net, and I also occasionally tweet stuff too. Yeah. Okay, so what we're going to be talking about today is how we can sort of build a great user experience on the client. So how we can sort of up the ante a bit, you know, let the users get a bit more of a good experience in what they're doing. Then we're going to have a look at how we can sort of respond to the data that comes back from that responsive site, and how do we can sort of pass that into Web API. So we're going to have a little bit of a look at that. Has everyone sort of played around with Web API yet in MVC 4? Just, you know, rough indication. Yeah, so a little bit of the room, so you guys will be familiar with how that works. Okay, we're going to have a look at going offline. So what do we need to do to prepare our apps to kind of work better offline? And it's not just going offline. It's about optimizing those resources so that perhaps that your users don't have to wait so long to start using the site that they're going to, you know, perform their tasks on. So we can sort of cache some of those resources locally using like the HTML5 cache manifest. And lastly, and I think this is just as important, is packaging. So how can you kind of package and minify all your resources so that you're delivering the most optimized set of resources down to your user? So, you know, merging all your CSS, merging all your JavaScript files. Okay, so building responsive web applications, I think it's about building for a wide audience because it's the web. So I think these first two points... So building for the web and also building for cross-platform, cross-browser, cross-device. So, you know, not just IE and Windows, but, you know, also Chrome, Firefox, all different browsers, all different platforms, and also the same with the mobile space. So responsive mobile apps, I think, is definitely a trend that's going to start, you know, continuing to rise into the future because it sort of gives you such a wide audience. So the first two points I've got here, I think, is it's nothing unusual for the web. So it's multi-browser, multi-platform. That's cool. We already kind of know that one. But it's more than that. So we want multi-form factor. So it's not just we're targeting our mobile phones. Maybe we also want to target sort of tablet computers. So the web kind of gives you, like, you know, the CSS3, which gives you that fluid sort of layout, which makes that a lot more flexible for us. And also multi-screen resolutions. So not all phones even have the same resolution. So I think the Androids coming out have kind of these 720p displays. You know, the Windows phones I think are 640 by 480, but that's going up with Windows Phone 8. So there's kind of a whole lot of devices that we can target just from our one application. So why build responsive mobile applications? So this is kind of one of those points that I was talking about. So we want a responsive, fluid usage and responding to on and offline events. So that might occur, say, when somebody has a, you know, like a Wi-Fi tablet and they walk out of Wi-Fi range, all of a sudden they lose their data connection. But maybe they would still be able to sort of browse and search that result set. And if you wanted to, I guess you could also get into sort of caching the updates to sort of replay at a later time. So that's what I mean by responding to sort of on and offline events. And for mobile devices, I think it's really important that you sort of make advantage of interacting with the device hardware and storage to sort of create a really personalized experience. So if you've got a mobile website and you're searching for, say accommodation, using like the user's sort of local location to sort of optimize their results is a really good thing to do. And that's definitely available for websites. And also you can sort of store information on the device about the user, so maybe their frequent searches, just to help personalize the app for them. So I think, you know, they're kind of really important things, and users really like just the little things that make that experience a little bit better. Because mobiles are, they are a personal device. So if you wanted to, while building what I call responsive web applications or single page apps, it's easier to package these for app stores. I've done a previous presentation where I actually did publish into the Google Play Store and the Windows Phone Store the exact same source code. So these apps, they're kind of responsible for more stuff. So they're responsible for, say, their own rendering and their own routing and their own animation logic. So that it's kind of like easier to get that experience and easier to get those into the store first. And then if you really want to, you can sort of maybe develop native applications at a later point, if you still need them even. So pretty charts. I like pretty charts. So this is important as well. So these are Australian statistics for owning a smartphone. So 2011-2012, it was 44%, and that's gone up in 1 year to 59%. So this is not just any phone, this is smartphones. So these are the ones that are actually going to make a difference, and people are actually using to sort of, you know, browse the internet. And the same kind of stats, so in the last 3 years, mobile web access or broadband access has gone up from 26% to 58%. So a lot more people are sort of kind of getting online on their mobile devices. So if you're not sort of looking at a mobile website or responsive mobile website, you know, now's the time to sort of, I definitely think, sort of start looking into that. And the kicker stat that I don't actually have here is that even at home, people are still using their mobile phones to access the internet even though they have a broadband connection and a computer in the next room. So, yeah, it would be crazy sort of, you know, to not sort of target your customers in that environment. So let's have a look at responsive web applications. So that's kind of the main focus to this talk as well. But these concepts, I think, apply just as well to both. So responsive web applications are kind of the best of desktop smart client applications. So it's that fluid user interface, you know, that beautiful experience that you get from traditional sort of smart client applications. But we're combining that with the best and the very latest of the web. So what I mean by that is we're getting all the benefits from the web. So the deployment story, they're using, you know, the latest sort of HTML5 technologies. CSS3 is making things really, really pretty. And it's also, you know, it's great for enhancing the user experience of web applications. So we don't want websites anymore. We want to transition across to, you know, having this great experience. So responsive options. So I've made this little chart or factor chart. You can kind of rank yourself of where on this chart that you think you are. So I think, of course, you've always got the option to do nothing. So if you've got your current website and you're like, man, that's good enough, it's sick, it's awesome. You can take that approach, and of course this approach is free, you don't have to do anything. But if you take the do nothing approach, then at least go and add in to the meta viewport tag. So at least what this is going to do is allow you to you know, scale a little bit better to device resolutions. So you don't, you know, get the 10,000 foot view of your website. It's going to be a little bit better than doing nothing, but, you know, not a lot. So the next level up is sort of adaptive layout. So let's introduce a little bit of CSS media queries into there. So if we, you know, start browsing it on an iPad or tablet computer, you know, we don't have our 27-inch desktop display anymore. All of a sudden, maybe we want to, you know, merge some of those columns down or drop it into sort of a one-column layout. And that can work well for anything from, you know, a desktop screen right down to a phone. But we're still serving the same HTML to every single client. So perhaps we're just sort of turning off a few, you know, large images or columns or things like that. But it's not the most optimized experience, you know, for all users, especially mobile users. So what you want to do is use adaptive rendering. So this is coming out, well, this is in MVC 4 now. You've been able to do it with a NuGet package since MVC 3, but that's built into MVC 4. And what that allows you to do is basically, you know, if a Windows phone hits your website, you can sort of serve an alternate view of that page. So you can actually serve on the same URL a mobile version of that content. So that's a great way to sort of optimize the user experience depending on the device or the computer that's accessing your site. So in my view, one up from that is also incorporating responsive client-side apps into your sites as well. So what that means is we're kind of going to move a little bit of logic from the server down to the client. And if you do that, you sort of give so much more to the user experience and so much more that you can do to respond to those device and client-side events. Okay, because we all had a really big night last night, it was awesome, Zorb Soccer, even I got in there, I thought I'd have like a little bit of a mini quiz, just to sort of get everyone thinking, right? So what I have is var my array, and I'm assigning that to a new array. So what I'm doing then is I'm assigning first and second to those two string values, and then I'm just going to alert myArray.length. So all you have to do is pick which answer you think is correct. So who thinks myArray.length would equal 0? So just raise your hand. It equals 0. Who thinks myArray.length equals 2? Don't be shy. Come on. You got into Zorb Soccer. I say so quite a few. Who thinks it would be undefined? No, not undefined. And who thinks that would just throw an exception that wouldn't even compile as crazy code? Yeah. Okay, so the answer here is actually 0. And I come across, like I said, I'm a consultant, I sort of get around, and I see these examples of JavaScript code where like you have to sort of understand what's going on, and you can't treat it like sort of C#. And that's an example of this. So the answer is 0 because there is no kind of dictionary in JavaScript. It's actually an array, which is fair enough. And in JavaScript, you would push items into the array. So what we've done here is actually we've created two properties on the myArray object. So we've created first and second and assigned those string values. Pretty good? Thinking now? Engaged? Yeah. Okay, so how can we... I'd like to move from that into how can we write better JavaScript? So I see a lot of patterns out there, and I've kind of labeled a pattern that I see, you know, time to time, which I would like to call the free-for-all pattern. And I've been able to sort of find a comic strip for that guy. So this is the free-for-all pattern. Yeah, so that's right. It's like, it's just basically get the job done. I've got a 5 o'clock deadline. You know, I want to go home, so I'm just going to hack out this 4,000-line JavaScript file. You know, I'm going to put some go-to statements in there, which is possible in JavaScript, by the way. But, you know what's going to happen. Eventually, the raptors, they will attack you. Okay? You're going to jeopardize probably, you know, the longevity of that project. It's going to be hard to maintain. Things aren't going to go so well. So we want to get rid of that, and I can get rid of that. There you go, ninja star. Okay, so here's some better options if you're looking for patterns. So the module pattern. So the module pattern is going to help you scope your JavaScript so you don't sort of pollute everything into the global DOM. So sort of an example of that is every time you declare a variable without the var keyword, it sort of goes to the default context, which is usually sort of window. So you're going to end up with a lot of stuff in the global DOM. And same with functions. If you declare those, they sort of, you know, default up to the default context. So module patterns help you sort of hide those into sort of internal scopes or, you know, like sort of private variables and expose out actually what you want to return. So namespaces are another common way of organizing code. And a lot of the Microsoft libraries use that. So the MS Ajax toolkit used that. WinJS takes that same kind of approach as, you know, all the dots. So another common pattern for writing client-side apps is MVC or MVC star. So Spine.js implements that, Backbone, JavaScript MVC, and I really like the way that the MVC sort of frameworks work on the client. So the last one is MVVM. So MVVM implementations would include Knockout, and there's also MVVM in WinJS, which I'm not sure if it supports two-way binding yet, but we'll see. And that's the one that we're going to talk about today, is MVVM. Okay, so this is a little bit of a diagram of MVVM. Is everyone familiar with this pattern? We're learning it for the... Yep. Okay, so not too much explanation necessary. Let's go. Okay, so an example of Knockout. Maybe just an indication of who is using Knockout or has played around with it. Okay, so it might be worth sort of going over this slide as well. So in this one, Knockout sort of lets you have this declarative binding to the DOM. So what we have up the top is the declarative binding, so using the HTML5, it's kind of a bit data bind attribute, and then we specify we want to bind to the text property and the property of first name. And the second line is we want to bind to the last name property. In the middle there, so we're defining a new view model, and we're going to say, this.firstname is an observable, and we're giving that a default value of Bert. And also last name, we're giving that a default value of Bertington. So then the final thing that you have to do in Knockout is kind of apply those bindings, and that's going to tell Knockout that it's time to go and parse the DOM and actually hook up all the observables. Yeah, simple enough. Okay, so once you're on top of these JavaScript patterns, the next thing you might want to do is use a UI toolkit to sort of make the pretty things happen. And there's kind of a number of good options available now that you might be looking into. So the most common one that I guess a lot of people are using is jQuery UI and jQuery Mobile. jQuery Mobile seems to have various levels of success depending on how you implement that, especially for sort of single page apps. Telerik has a commercially supported one, so Kendo UI and Kendo UI Mobile. So the reason why I have that here is it's basically because Telerik includes an MVVM pattern in their option as well. So if you're looking for a commercially supported version, might be a way to go. So also Twitter Bootstrap. So Twitter Bootstrap is free. It already includes a lot of sort of responsive layouts, a responsive design. And there's sort of a lot of little things that you see it and you're like, man, they put a lot of work, a lot of thought into this. And that it even includes support for the HTML5 form elements. So in an HTML5 form element, if you say something is required and you don't have anything in there, it becomes into an invalid state. So that's only supported in, IE10, more modern sort of browsers, Chrome, things like that. But it actually sort of colours the box red for you, like with CSS. So they've put a lot of thought into, supporting modern markup. So I've got a little table there, and that's just my experience about how these libraries sort of interact across mobile devices and also on desktop. So when I say desktop, obviously I've generalized a lot. And by that, I mean modern browsers, so IE10, modern Chrome, modern Firefox, things like that. So they've all got excellent support. Portable devices are kind of various levels, but they're catching up. So I've got high hopes for Windows Phone 8. Okay, so like I said before, HTML form elements are a great way to sort of give users a more native experience. And that's things like sort of taking advantage of the import types. So if you've got a text box and you're only putting numbers in there, so say, like an Australian postcode, you could sort of specify that as being a number. So even in older browsers, if they don't support input type equals number, the default is actually text. So if they don't support it, they default back to text. So it is a great option to support modern browsers, but also, it falls back nicely. And if the browser doesn't support it, then you can sort of use the library modernizer to sort of optionally load in that polyfill that can sort of support that validation later on. So yeah, everyone's heard of modernizer, right? Yeah, lots of nods. Okay, so traditional apps. This is nothing new, I'm sure, to everyone. So a device makes a request, goes to our MVC4 server, it does a little bit of processing, and then it returns a view. Yeah. So that's how traditional apps, and it keeps working like that. So the user wants another page, they click a link, and then it does the same thing again. It does a request, process, response. So structuring responsive apps happens a little bit differently. So the first bit's the same. The client makes a request, goes to the MPC 4 server. But then it gives back, you know, what I'd kind of call like this bootstrapping page. So it's got a little bit of markup in there that, you know, might structure the app or tell it the initial bootstrapping library to load. So in this case, I like to use a library called require.js, and that kind of helps you manage client-side dependencies or client-side JavaScript dependencies. So here's like a she, he's like a bootstrapper. So he says, you know, this application requires all these libraries, so I'll go and start loading those in for you. So he, you know, starts loading those partials and libraries in and starts instantiating those, so it gives you like an entry point to the application. In this case, I'm using MVVM, so I might start, you know, instantiating my view models and applying those to the DOM, so that, you know, starts all, gets up and running. So once I've done that, my page is basically initialized, and I can start, you know, animating stuff in and out, and I want to fetch. Obviously, I want to start fetching data. So after we've got all this on the client, we don't need to make a lot of HTML requests. So what happens then is we just need to do these tiny little JSON requests with the server that just, you know, update the server or fetch updates from the server. Or, you know, the server can even push updates down to the client using libraries like SignalR. So what happens then is, you know, maybe the client, you know, has the mobile tablet with Wi-Fi and they walk out of a Wi-Fi hotspot. So they get disconnected. So because we've got all of this logic on the client, we can sort of handle that event more gracefully. And although it's out of sort of the scope of this talk, you know, you might want to sort of go and store that in HTML5 local storage to sort of synchronize those changes later on. Okay. So application composition. So I've just mentioned the require.js library, and that actually implements like a pattern called common.js. So I think I've got common.js, the link's down there in the corner. It's worth having a read. There's a whole bunch of patterns there. So require.js implements what's known as like a module pattern and an asynchronous module definition. So I think that's also referred to as AMD. Node.js also implements these standards as well, so it's you know, quite a well-known pattern. It's not going to go away in the future, so it's worth sort of reading and knowing about. And this sort of handles those client-side dependencies, it handles ordering them, it handles all of these types of things. So another common thing that you'll see out there is script loaders. So script loaders are a different thing. They don't implement common.js necessarily. So script loaders are good at like loading things in parallel or conditionally loading things. So an example of that one is the first item there, which is yep, nope, which basically has a condition. If the condition is no, then it'll load something, and then you can sort of fire callbacks when that's completed. So maybe a good use for a script loader is using like a polyfill library, where you know you're conditionally patching in functionality. So the demo app that I'd like to sort of run through today is called Tiny Contact Manager. So the other week, when I was at my sort of favorite Mexican restaurant here on the coast, I had a look and I started talking to the owner as I was paying, and she said, well, what do you do? And I said, help people write websites and software. And she's like, oh, have I got a deal for you? She said, I will give you free fajitas if you write me a little bit of software to sort of manage my birthday vouchers. So call me cheap. But I said, wow, yeah, man, that's a pretty good offer. So what she had is this little green card here. So somebody comes in and they want, you know, they want to sign up because they want to get a voucher on their birthday. So they fill in this little card and they give it back to her. So she takes that home to her office, and I'm assuming it's her office, and she puts it in like a manila folder. So when the next month comes up, so you know, October, she's like, all right, need to go and send out those vouchers. So she goes to the manila folder and picks out all the October birthdays and then starts, you know, writing cards, little voucher cards, and then sends those out. So it's taken quite a while. So that's the inspiration for the app here. And that's the functionality that it's doing. So let's have a look at what that might look like. So these screenshots were taken a little while ago as the app was kind of being built. It was in progress. So basically, we kind of have this administration app on one side, and it's going to be, you know, built using sort of MVVM and responsive style UI. And then if she accesses it, you know, with her tablet computer while she's on site, then she's going to get like a mobile registration form that she can sort of give to people and they can just type their details straight in. So that's kind of the example that I was thinking of, you know, maybe if, you know, the Wi-Fi wasn't working at that time, then you can kind of synchronize those changes later. Okay, so I'd like to jump into a little bit of code and actually show you guys, you know, we'll click around the app and see what's going on, and then sort of have a look at a bit of the structure. So let's jump over. Okay, I've got Visual Studio running, which is always a good start. Okay, so let's have a look at that first page. That's that first block of HTML that's served down to the client. Let's have a look at the layout. Okay, so when this is served down to the client, you know, I've done step one already. I've got, you know, my meta view put in here. So this is, can everyone see that up the back? Is that too small? Want it a bit bigger? Okay, no, we'll go with that. Yeah, so I've got my meta view put tag in there. So it's going to render slightly to devices that access the site. But this is the administration side, so I don't really care too much about sort of mobile users. To cater for the mobile users, I'm using what I've said before, so the MVC4 view modes. So when a mobile site accesses that, I can detect those and I can give them the alternate layout. So I'll show that when I run it. And the first line of JavaScript here, so that's, if you can sort of see that up the back. Oops, magnifier is in the way. Okay, so this is, so this first line of JavaScript sort of says, the JavaScript file is require.js. Yep. And then what he has is this data main attribute, and that's kind of the entry point or the bootstrapper for the application. So it loads in the require.js library, and once that guy's loaded, he looks for that data main attribute, and then he starts loading that bootstrapper and executing my application. Yep, so easy enough. So if we jump into main, so this is the bootstrapper, this is what's going to get run. So at the top you can sort of have like a shim, so if you want to rename libraries to be, you know, more convention-based, you can do that. So I like to do that thing for things like you know, getting rid of the version number out of, say, Knockout. So if a new version comes out, I can kind of change it here and it sort of changes that module all over the application. So it makes it really easy. If we scroll down, I've got quite a few dependencies in this one. Okay, so down here is probably the most next interesting bit. So I've sort of written a little bit of a wrapper around this so that I can basically instantiate a view model, and I'm going to pull that out of require.js. I'm going to ask require.js, you know, give me my main view model. It's going to resolve that for me. And the next part I'm passing in is the section of the DOM that I want that view model to be applied to. So I've kind of just wrapped that up into one line so I don't have to do it manually. And then there's that, you know, ever-important line of once we've kind of created that view model, we want to sort of apply it to the DOM. So this next apply bindings is another little wrapper, and it basically calls knockout dot apply bindings to sort of get those observables bound to the view. Okay, so let's run that up. Okay, so that's, I've already pressed play, so we don't have to wait for it to compile. There's two versions, which we'll get back to later. Okay, so this is the interface here. Yep. Can everyone see that at the back? Yep, generally. Okay, so what it is I've already sort of preloaded, I think, 100 random contacts from a random contact generation tool. And what we have is it's loaded in the data set. So after I've got that, I can order people by birthday. It's going to give me a little bit of description. And we can also sort that. And because they're cards, and we're using sort of CSS3 and sort of later browser technologies, we can just, you know, use a bit of a shuffle library to sort of reorder them and animate those into the correct position. So that's what I'm sort of saying is, you know, we're sort of veering away from postbacks and things like that, and we're sort of getting more into, you know, let's do a little bit more work on the client, but let's make the experience that much better. And the same kind of works if we go and, say, do a search for someone. So if I type in T, we can sort of see, you know, the irrelevant contacts disappearing. You know, and then, you know, I found Ryan in, say, two clicks. So they're kind of the things that I'm getting at is you know, it's very little things, but it's starting to make the experience a little bit better. So say we want to, you know, send a birthday card out really, really early to Ryan, we can kind of bring him up. And I've got an export button here. And that's kind of switching to another view. So I'm hiding the old view, I'm fading in the new view, and I've done, you know, no refreshes. This is all sort of client-side rendered. And when that's done, I can click confirm. And that's sort of created that mailing record on the server. And if you're observant enough, you would have seen that now we've got this little... I'll zoom into that. So now we've got this little icon appeared down in the corner. So this is updated. It hasn't done a refresh. There's a little icon down in the corner that said we've sent out the voucher a few seconds ago. If all goes well, Ryan gets his voucher and he's like, man, them fajitas are good. So he comes in and we want to, you know, record the fact that he's enjoyed his fajitas. So I've kind of hidden all the actions initially from the view side of the card. So if we click that, it kind of just flips over. And then we've got a new button here called redeemed voucher. So just in case he's, you know, photocopying these vouchers at home, because the fajitas are that good. Okay, so if we look here, we can sort of see all the contacts that have come in and redeemed those vouchers. So obviously, if they haven't been sent a voucher, they're not going to have that button. So Knockout is kind of responsible for determining, you know, what buttons are visible and what's not. Yeah, so that's kind of the basis of the app. So I think one of the other key factors when you're writing responsive client-side apps is it's great to sort of, you know, update the UI on the fly as you're going, but another thing is, because we're kind of handling a lot of the rendering logic on the client, why do you have to wait for a refresh? I mean, there's a lot of libraries out there now, so we're going to have... So this is Chrome. We're going to have a bit of a browser war. So if I was skipping on to, say, the same... There we go. Yeah, I might just refresh that to make sure these guys are both connected. Okay, so we're refreshing on to the same month, hopefully. Yep, so January. So say I've got, you know, maybe multiple staff members working in here. Let's go this one so we can see it. And I accidentally update... Lachlan. So he changes his name to Lachlan 2. Not quite sure why. So on the other screen, if you can sort of see that there, we pushed an update down from the server that says, somebody else has already, you know, changed this contact and I've just refreshed the view for you. You might sort of want to add another prompt to say, you know, do you want to lose your changes or override theirs? It's kind of a start to sort of recognize that you don't have to wait for the information. You don't have to wait for a refresh or the client to do something to get that new data. You can push it straight down from the server. So this is using a library called SignalR. There's a lot of libraries around that can sort of help you do that, both paid and free. So SignalR you host yourself. So it kind of extends a little bit more from that as well. So we've got Lachlan 2 over here, but he changes his name back because he's like, man, I don't want to be the second. I want to be the first. So if we hit changes there, the view sort of updates almost simultaneously on both. So that's great. And that kind of works just as well for mailing records. So if I type over here, and let's send these guys some mailing records.
Are there any performance
tweaks
with this?
So what do you mean by that? Yeah, so the question was, is there any performance hits by this sort of constantly updating? So because it's using SignalR, are you familiar how SignalR kind of works a little bit? Yeah, so it kind of has a number of options, basically from, you know, sort of asynchronous communication down to like what they call long polling, which I think is its last fallback. So long polling is it kind of connects to the server and it says, you know, hold this connection open. And all it does is it just sits there and waits. So as soon as the server has an update, it just writes it to that connection and it goes straight down. So when the client gets it, it kind of, you know, processes that data and then connects up again and waits for the next thing. So that's kind of the ultimate fallback. But, you know, since then we've got, you know, more modern ways up to, say, WebSockets. So the performance implications, I think it's actually better because what I'm doing here is when a contact is updated, I just send the JSON object of that contact down to the client. So once the client's got that contact, all he needs to do is basically, you know, tell Knockout that, you know, I've got a new object, suck in the new data elements. So Knockout will then just rebind it to the UI. So I think the way this is set up is actually quite efficient. Okay, so are there any other quick questions about what we've got going on here? Say again, sorry.
Do you have the source available
somewhere? Yep, we'll get to that at the end. Cool. All right, I'll flick over and let's keep going. Yep, that's on. Okay, cool. Okay, so we've seen all these things going on the UI. So the next part would be, let's have a look at what's going on the server. So Web API is built into MVC4, and that's sort of a great leg up if you're sort of writing these client-side or responsive client-side apps, because it provides sort of a great way to pass in that data. And there's also those things that you'd expect, like built-in support. So if you send a data type JSON, it'll pass in JSON. If you pass in XML, it'll pass in that XML into the models for you. I think this sort of model, this kind of application, you're going to have a bigger service layer and sort of a little bit of code on the client that can just, perform those requests. And the other great thing about Web API is it supports sort of that RESTful interface, so you can use puts and deletes as well as posts and gets, obviously. But it kind of makes more semantic sense to say, if I want to delete that contact, I just send, HTTP delete to that resource URL, so I can actually delete it. So yeah, good semantic sense, which is, what REST is all about. Okay, so another quick demo. Let's have a quick look at Web API. Okay, so there's the screen. All right, my controllers. I've got a context controller. Okay, so at the top here, it's pluralized, so it's called contacts. And that kind of fits the convention. So the convention for the default route for Web API sort of says API / contacts / the function that you want to access. Now, so I've got a number of these set up. If I don't specify anything, it becomes a GET request. I could also provide a GET request for a single contact. In this case, I'm providing all the contacts, so I can kind of do my searches and filtering on the client. If you've got, say, thousands of records or hundreds of records, maybe you want to break this down into kind of page results or a different method of doing it. So the first one here is a post. So I want to post a new contact to that URL, and that's going to get created. I've got a put request. So just by using HTTP put up the top, there's also a convention built into Web API where you can kind of type put on the front of the method as well. So I've used this one because I think it's fairly clear also. So put request means, update the thing that's already there, update the resource that's already there, and also delete. HTTP delete, so, delete the contact at this address. So is everyone okay with that? It's not a big example, but it's kind of simple enough to sort of get the job done that I've got going here. Back over to slides. Okay, so working with async. So if we've got all these JSON requests now and our app's going to keep running in the background, then another great pattern that you sort of want to get across is called the promise pattern. So the promise pattern has been around, or I shouldn't say been around, been implemented in jQuery since version 1.5, so that's been there for a while now. So what you do is you kind of, it's built into things like AJAX requests. You can set them up yourself if you're performing your own sort of asynchronous work and want callbacks. And it kind of allows you to chain together what I should do next. So do this AJAX request, then perform this function. So it's great because if you're sort of passing in functions into every callback, then you kind of get this like Christmas tree effect of callbacks, essentially. So things like this promise pattern allow you to chain together the actions in a lot more of a succinct way. So it's not new. Microsoft know about it too. So it's in WinJS as well. So when you're writing Windows 8 apps, the WinJS.xhr object also implements a similar promise pattern. Obviously, a slightly different library, but it's got a similar API. So I'd like to talk next about cache manifest. So cache manifest is that guy that's going to allow us to cache those resources efficiently on the client. So the first rule of cache manifest is to declare it as cache manifest. The next line there, so the double hash bang, sort of represents that it's a comment line. And the thing about cache manifest is they don't expire. So what you have to do, and a common pattern out there, is to kind of provide this comment line that specifies the version or revision of the manifest. So when the manifest changes, the browser can sort of see that change, and then he's going to go and revalidate the resources that are in there. So the next section is a cache section. So this represents the explicitly cached items. So the items that I explicitly wanted to download and cache as part of my web application. And the last one is called the network section. So when I use a star there, I'm basically saying, if I haven't explicitly said that you should cache it, it exists on the network, so you should fetch it from there. The only thing to be aware of here is if you sort of miss something from that cache section and you're offline, obviously the network section is not going to work. So you could use another section, which I haven't specified here, called a fallback, to sort of specify what to do if that resource is not there. Okay, so what I like to do, because we've got sort of MVC4 backing our web application, is to use MVC4 to programmatically build that, right? Because if the version's changing all the time, you know, I don't want to edit files, I could hook it up to, you know, say an assembly version or a build number or a timestamp or, you know, a database row stamp or something, whatever you want to do that makes it unique for that revision of your application. So I thought I'll jump into my resource controller and I'll show you what I've got set up. Okay, we're on the screen. Okay, so this is a resource controller. And here I've got a thing that I'm calling a cache manifest builder. So this is a class that I've written, so it's just a little utility library. It's nothing fancy. So what it's doing is I've provided sort of a similar API. So this is the way that I want to scan and add resources to that. So all I want to do is I'm providing maybe a similar API to the bundling that's in MVC4. So I just want to add a directory, say, /images. I want all the PNG files. And I'm providing, you know, I'm also giving the option to say I want to keep searching recursively down the directories. I can also use, say, add file to sort of explicitly add a couple of the files that I want. And then I've also got one down the bottom where I can just add, you know, a generic line to a section, because obviously star is not really a file. So the last thing that you have to do is you have to serve it as a text/cache manifest media type. So then obviously the helper.toString is going to build that and sort of format that document for me and serve it with the correct type. So when that's done, the browser is going to pick it up. So Chrome has a quite a good browser for this. So I'm going to switch over to console. Okay, I'll refresh this in and I'll zoom in. Oops, something's not defined. All right, so that's at the top. Now, so if I zoom in here, so this is what you'll start to see once you add that cache manifest to your document. It's added to your document up in the HTML tag, and you just sort of specify a manifest and then the file where your manifest is, or in MVC4, you can just specify the route that's going to serve that content. So at the top, Chrome has picked that up, he's found it, and he said, this document was loaded from application cache with manifest. And if we click that, we can sort of see the files that I've included in that manifest. So my version is a little bit unique. I'm using, I think, the timestamp from my last assembly build, plus a database record timestamp as well, I think. So I just want to make sure, because I'm allowing the client to cache my data set, you know, I want my resource to change when that changes as well. So let's just have a look at where that's included, and that should wrap that bit up. Okay, so at the top, we've got HTML manifest equals desktop.manifest. So I've defined a route called for desktop.manifest, which maps to my appropriate MVC4 route. Yeah, so pretty easy, right? It's not too hard to do. You may get in the situation where you make a mistake with your manifest file, so you kind of forget to add that revision in there. All of a sudden, it doesn't expire, so Chrome is going to keep remembering it. And it's going to remember it for the URL. So even if you delete it from the HTML, Chrome will still say, no, I've got this manifest file for your site. And it'll still keep loading those resources from that cache. So what do you do then? It does actually have a browser, so chrome/appcacheinternals, and that's going to allow you to see all the cache manifest files that Chrome is storing for various sites. So here's my local one at the top. I can view the entries for it. And then if I'm like, nah, that one was bad, I kind of screwed up, it allows me to remove it. Best feature ever. Okay, it definitely allows you to keep continuing to build your site. Okay, let's get back to the slides. Okay, so although it's a little bit out of the scope of this talk, so I mentioned before that you can use sort of local storage if you want to kind of, you know, store local things about the user or the data offline. So local storage is part of the HTML5 technology group or group of technologies. But beware if you're using it. The access can vary based on privacy settings of the device, and you've also sort of got to take into account the storage capacity. So I can't tell you what they are. Generically, it's about 5 to 10 megabytes. That's generically. But that can vary a lot depending on, you know, IE10 on, you know, Windows 8 or whatever it is. So the privacy settings I mentioned, if you're sort of making mobile sites, if you're serving those to iOS devices and they've got private browsing mode on, yes, the device supports local storage. No, it won't let you put anything in there. It sort of just throws this, you've exceeded your storage capacity exception. The great news is as well, it's available in PhoneGap, even on Windows Phone 7. So PhoneGap team have kind of, you know, provided a little bit of extra code to make that possible. Yes, question?
What percentage of iOS users would have private browsing enabled, disabled, and any stats on that?
So the question was, what percentage of iOS users have this private browsing mode turned on? I'm not sure. Good question. But if you're aware of it, you can have code that kind of deals with that instead of, you know, having a JavaScript exception in a sort of a single page app or a responsive app is not a good thing. Okay, yep, let's move on. So a bit of a recap. We've got one section left, but I thought, you know, now's a great time to sort of recap everything we've covered so far. Because there's been a few things. So we've talked about why we sort of need these responsive apps and, you know, the great experience that we're going to give our users. We've talked about some client-side patterns and some better alternatives to the free-for-all, so no more 4,000-line files. Some UI toolkits, so how we can sort of make those animations appear smoother. So in my demo, I've used a lot of CSS3 libraries or little CSS3 utility libraries to do those transitions. A lot of those libraries are still kind of, let's say, transitioning to support IE10. So even though IE10 supports a lot of the CSS functionality, there seems to be quite a few libraries out there that are still kind of, escaping early when it detects IE in general. So what those guys need to do is, you know, stop sniffing for browsers and start sniffing for feature support. Why you should be using the HTML forms and the HTML form tags, give your users a nicer experience if their device or if their browser supports it. So Chrome already, you know, has a built-in date picker, for example. Web API, so it's, you know, a great sort of option to use if you are building these REST-based interfaces and want to pass those JSON requests up and synchronize stuff. We've talked about cache manifest files, what they look like, how to generate them, and how they sort of cache locally. Okay, so the last section I want to talk about is bundling and minification. So how can we get all of these resources down into the most compact form possible and deliver those to the browsers? So the the one that's coming with MVC4, and probably the easiest way to go is system web optimizations. So that's, you know, it's a good library and the API is quite good. But because I was already using RequireJS to kind of, you know, manage my client-side dependencies, there's actually a tool called the RequireJS Optimizer. So RequireJS Optimizer requires Node.js to run And there's also another similar product called Stack Service Bundler. So Stack Service Bundler, I would say, would be the Node version of System Web Optimizations. So you kind of have a file, you specify all the dependencies, and it minifies that into one output. RequireJS Optimizer works differently, so he kind of inspects that bootstrapping application, or that bootstrapper that I have. He looks at the dependencies of that. He then goes to that guy's dependencies and looks at those. If that guy has dependencies, he looks at those. And then he kind of determines the correct order for the scripts before he generates that final minified file. So I figure, right, you know, if I'm going to use RequireJS, I might as well take advantage of that and not sort of have those, you know, out-of-order script problems. Node.js, if you don't have it, if you haven't looked at it, I won't judge you. But now's a good time to go and have a look. So Node.js, even Microsoft have done a lot of work to kind of, you know, make that work well on Windows. So Node.js on Windows uses I/O completion ports. So it's kind of the very best of the Windows kernel, you know, to sort of manage those asynchronous operations. It's getting easier every version. So there's an installer. It's an MSI. You double-click it. It installs. And then you can basically start using it. So it's really good. A lot of the packages, we're still waiting for better support for Windows because they're kind of, you know, tied into a few Linux-y, Unix-y things. But more and more packages are kind of supporting, you know, both operating systems. So definitely it's going to be something to keep an eye on. Question?
I was just wondering with JScript and Node.js on the server side,
yes.
It as a language on the server side, are all the C# libraries and things exposed to it, or is it a different set?
Okay, so the question was, are C# libraries exposed to the Node.js on the server side?
Yeah, on the server side, can you do all the same things in JScript as you can in C# in terms of, I don't know, whatever you might want to do?
Yeah, so the question is... Yeah, so what can Node.js do on the server side? Is it sort of comparable to C#? So you can't use, say, C# style stuff per se, but there's kind of alternatives. So for instance, people are kind of writing drivers for, you know, Node.js to SQL Server, Node.js to MongoDB, Node.js to, you know, like a whole bunch of other things. So as kind of a server product and as a language, it's growing quite rapidly. I think the first example I supported was, you know, the ability to have a web server. So it support is growing, and like I say, it's something to definitely keep an eye on. So this slide sort of shows how we might sort of go and install RequireJS using Node. So after you've got Node installed, you've found the MSI, you've double-clicked that, it's installed. It comes with a thing called Node Package Manager. So maybe you could sort of think of that as being kind of a NuGet for Node. It sort of allows you, or an apt-get for Linux... Is that Linux? So it kind of allows you to go and fetch those libraries and install them locally. So if I was going npm, so Node Package Manager, install RequireJS, -g just says install it globally, so I can use it on any project. The next line says node execute rjs, which is the optimizer script, and pass in that build configuration that I've made for my project. So what I want to do is demo how easy it was to use the RequireJS optimizer with Visual Studio in my MVC4 project. Okay, so the good news is we've actually been using it the whole time. Okay, so I've just hit build, and I like to sort of modify my demo right up till about 3 minutes before I present. Okay, so I'll zoom in here. Okay, so what's happened up the top? So it said... I know it's a little bit gray and hard to see, so I'll read it out. It says, tracing dependencies for main. So that's my entry to my application. The second line is I've kind of excluded one of the files from being, you know, built into that package. The third line says it's uglifying, using a library called Uglify. So it's kind of, uglifying and minifying my package file. And then it's listing out all the JavaScript files that it's merged into one. So you don't have to write a 4,000-line file anymore because RequireJS is going to merge that all in for you. So you can have as many JavaScript files as you want, make them modular, make them, you know, do the one thing that they're supposed to do, and then use one of the optimizers to kind of package those all down into the version that you're going to deliver. So RequireJS also works for CSS, and so does System Web Optimizations. So it doesn't matter which one of those you use. I've just used RequireJS Optimizer again to optimize my CSS. So it's kind of merged all of those together into the one CSS file. Okay. And just for good measure, I have a rebuild.bat as well. So if I double-click that, it calls essentially the same command. So I can kind of, you know, run it outside of Visual Studio if I want to, you know, make really sure that I've compressed all my resources together. So yeah, it kind of works with you. You don't even know it's there. It's just set up as a post-build command. So my project successfully builds and it merges all my resources together. So it's really sort of, you know, not a step out of your everyday development. So the best resources are still yet to come. But let's just talk about what the major areas that we've been over. So building at a great user experience. So we've had a look at that app, what it requires, a few of those techniques. Data and web API, so you know, passing the JSON request to the web API. What we need to do to go offline, so the cache manifest stuff, and packaging, so how do we get all those resources into that sort of compact delivery format. So if you want to know more about JavaScript, I recommend... Oh, we've got ticks as well. Yes, yes, yes. I recommend these books. So JavaScript Web Applications is by an author called Alex McCaw, and he sort of goes across a lot of the MVC-style single-page apps. So he talks a lot about Spine. He gives you an intro to Backbone. It's a good book to sort of understand how to sort of structure those apps and more about you know, programming those in general. And also The Secrets of the JavaScript Ninja by John Riesig. It's not actually a full book yet. It's still in early access program, which it has been for about 2 years. But nonetheless, it's still a good book on JavaScript. And because you know he did write the jQuery library, he sort of gives you a lot of tips about writing that cross-platform JavaScript and actually sort of you know understanding more about JavaScript in general. Okay, so if you want to watch more about building responsive apps and single-page apps, there's a whole bunch of good resources already online. So there's one by Phil Hack on Channel 9. I think you can get the slides sort of after the event as well. There's a few by Steve Sanderson, so maybe just sort of you know write down the names if you want to, do a search for those. And if you want to know a little bit more about Node.js, then go and watch the Douglas Crockford video on server-sideness. So that's kind of understanding a little bit more about you know how Node works and understanding, I think, the, you know, the law of turns. There's also another video which was released recently, which is on Pluralsight. So Pluralsight have actually been you know kind enough to give me a couple more of these monthly subscriptions. So if you want one of those, come and see me after. And it's called... Actually, yeah, it's basically on all the same technologies that I've presented here, and it's by an author called John Papa. I think I've said that right. And yeah, I think it's about a 4 or 6 hour course on all of these areas. So if you want a lot more detail and a lot more stuff in depth, definitely go and check that out. So stuff to think about. So what was one of the patterns that you can use to sort of help you develop these responsive apps? What's one of the features in MVC 4 that sort of helps you building responsive apps? And would you guys consider sort of building a responsive app for your next project? I hope so. Okay, so the code, I said I'd get back to it. So the code is available at tinycontactmanager.codeplex.com. You can sort of check out, yep, all the bits, it's all there. I still may revise it after this talk. Still want to you know, keep improving that a little bit more. Related content. It animates in. Okay, so if it's captured your imagination and you want to have a bit more of a chat about it, you can find me, say, after the break at the speaker lounge area in, is it the showcase area? So I'll be there sort of after the break for a little bit. And we can. I'd love to sort of hear about what projects you guys are doing and where this kind of might fit in. So that'd be great. Remember to do evaluations, and hopefully you've enjoyed everything that I've presented on. Thank you. Okay, so all the stuff is not over yet. We can ask some more questions now. I've got t-shirts to give away if you want a t-shirt. I've got Pluralsight cards to give away if you want to go and access those videos online.